Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette. I'm Greta Johnson, and I am so freaking excited to tell you our guest this week is George R.R. Martin. This nerd probably needs no introduction, but just in case, the short version is he wrote a bunch of books that became an insanely popular HBO series that you probably have heard of. It's called Game of Thrones. He still has two more books in that series to write. He hasn't quite finished them yet. I'm sorry to say in this episode, we do not have like a publishing date for you, but we did have a really great conversation. We talked about how he manages fan expectations and the future of fantasy, and we talk about how writing those books is going. So without further ado, here's the interview. George R.R. Martin, perhaps one of the world's most famous nerds. Welcome to Nerdette.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad to be here. So, it's interesting that the word nerd has now become a good thing.
Right?
I'm so old, I remember when it was a bad thing, being called that in high school. Very traumatic.
So, yeah, how do you feel about it now? Do you kind of lean into it?
Yeah, sure.
I'm
always interested in the definitions, you know. Is a nerd different from a geek? And if so, what is the precise differences?
I mean, the way we've always thought of nerd is, like, you can be a nerd about, it doesn't really matter what the thing is, it's about how excited you are about it, right? So that means you can be a nerd about anything. Like, you could be a sci-fi fantasy nerd just as easily as you could be a Latin nerd or a knitting nerd or, you know, it's just
NFL
about what you love.
Nerd.
Exactly.
Okay, cool.
Exactly.
Right, all right.
So, you know, the door's wide
That's
open.
Good.
Anybody's welcome in the club,
I'll gladly embrace several varieties of nerds.
Right? I figured you would. Yeah. It seemed accurate. It's not too much of a stretch, right? So my first question for you is just, you know, like, I know when I read a book that I really love, I find myself spending time there when I'm not even reading it. You know, I'll have that moment where I'm like, what do you think Harry and Hermione are up to right now? And it had me wondering, as someone who created such a rich tapestry of a world, how much time do you spend in Westeros these days?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. That really varies, and it depends on what I'm doing. But when I am actively writing, when it's really going well, and it doesn't always go well by any means, there are good days and bad days, there are good months and bad months. But when it's going well, I live in Westeros. I fall through the computer. I wake up thinking of, you know, Tyrion and Arya or Aegon the Conqueror, whoever I'm writing about. And I go to sleep at night thinking about them. And when I'm driving around, I think about them. And it just fills my life. But in order to achieve this almost, Zen state of obsession,
uh-huh,
I have to push away real life.
Uh-huh.
There are other writers who I know, like, write 4 pages a day. They write in hotels. They write on airplanes. They write everywhere. I've never been one of those writers.
I need to completely separate.
I need to have the whole day just to write, nothing else on my calendar. And it's a odd irony that the very success of Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire, the popularity of these books, has made it harder for me to write these books because the number of interruptions and distractions and other things have increased, doubled and tripled and increased tenfold and 100-fold.
Right, because essentially what you're saying is when you spend days, you know, for example, doing interviews with nerdy podcasts,
that's right,
you're not able to write.
That's right. I am not writing today. I'm here in Chicago.
Yeah.
When I'm back home in Santa Fe, I will be pushing everything and writing, yes. And I know some of my readers and fans are very impatient about that. They wish I was like the other writers who, you know, like Stephen King, who I talked to once on a show we did together about this very thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of those guys who writes 6 pages a day. come hell or high water, or his cat just got run over, or whatever happens, Stephen King writes his 6 pages a day. I wish I could be like that, but I can't.
How are you managing fan expectations these days?
I don't think I do manage them.
What do you mean by that?
I've learned to live with them.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, for most of my career, now a lot of people just know me from A Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire.
Mm-hmm.
But the first book of that came out in 1996. Well, I published my first story in 1971. So I was already a well-established author. I'd written a half dozen novels. I'd written 60, 70, 80 short stories. I'd won awards. I was pretty well-established.
Yeah.
But in those days and in that stage of my career, I worked largely in anonymity. In fact, on many of my novels, I didn't even tell my agents that I was working on it. A lot of writers work on a basis of they write 3 sample chapters and an outline, and they sell the book, and then they're given a deadline for it. I never liked that model because, you know, I was never good with deadlines. Even when I was a student at Medill up here in Evanston.
The journalism graduate school.
Yeah, deadlines I didn't take, you know, when they—
That's a Medill F there,
too. Do you want to go into magazine or newspaper, you know? I said, newspaper, deadlines every day? No, I don't think I'll go for magazine.
Give you a little more time.
Monthly magazine, you know, give me a little time to finish the article. That would be better. So I never sold my novels that way. I would start to work on a novel, and then when it was finished, I would call up my agent and say, oh, look, I finished a novel. Here
You're
it is.
Welcome.
Please
Ta-da.
Go sell it for me. And they would.
That's great.
But when I started A Song of Ice and Fire, and the books came out, and they became increasingly popular, largely through word of mouth, you know, each one doing better than the last and building up a certain amount of momentum. Suddenly, people began anticipating the next one. And for the first time, I got ripples of, well, when is the next one coming out? Oh, why isn't it coming out this year? This other writer over here, he publishes a book every year.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not that other writer. I've always been slow.
Yeah.
I mean, I have people who started 20 years after me who have like 40 novels in print. And
I have
like 10. And it just increased as the series became more and more popular.
Of course.
And I had this not a blog, which I started, you know, I was like the last person in the world. I started blogging when everybody else had stopped blogging and switched to Twitter. I'm always a little behind the curve here, you know. And I tried to explain. I figured the fans would, well, I'm working on it, guys. Don't worry. It'll come out eventually. I thought that would do it, but it didn't do it. It was like, well, it did it for some people. I mean, once again, you know, I get 100 people saying, take as long as you want, no problem. But for some, it was just throwing gasoline on the fire. Well, that's not an explanation. What are you doing? Why are you should be home writing, you know. Why are you doing anything? And at a certain point, I gave up trying to manage fan expectations.
Yeah.
I just said, well, you know, I'm writing it. It'll be done when it's done.
Yeah.
Some days I have good days and I write 5-6 pages. That's a great day for me. Some days I struggle and, you know, barely get half a page done. Some days I go in and I look at what I wrote last week and say, this is all terrible. And I rip it up and start it all over again.
So that has me wondering, I mean, I think we're at such a fascinating time of fandom, right? I mean, speaking of nerdery, I think especially makers are facing so much pressure from their fans in a way that they didn't before simply because of the internet, right? It's like people can tweet at you all the time.
Right.
And I wonder, like, in some ways, I think that's a really beautiful thing. I think it's really exciting that people love something enough to have that much passion and that many strong opinions about it. But I imagine for a guy like you, that can also be really frustrating.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I think like most writers, and I think this is true of the vast majority of writers and probably a lot of artists of other sorts too, you know, we like praise. And it you know, we absorb it eerily like sponges, but in one sense it slides off our back. And we hate criticism. So, you know, I can get 100 good reviews and people saying, great, we love you, go on.
And
then one guy who's snarking
one.
At me and I'll obsess
fixate,
about that,
that
bad review.
I call that
or
picking
that
a scab in my brain, you
that's
know?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I admit to that, at least. There's a lot of writers who, bad reviews don't bother me. They're lying. They does bother them. I know their secrets behind closed doors. So you know, there are good things about the internet, certainly, and, and like everybody else living in 21st century America, I'm addicted to it. But like many addictions, I don't think it's necessarily good for you. And there are what I think is really bad things about the internet. And I'm not just talking – let me make this very clear here, because I've given other interviews where I've made general statements about the internet, and then it gets picked up on websites and made as if I'm talking directly about my fans or sponsors to Ice and Fire. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm talking about
– just the way it is
everything
generally.
Kind of discourse on the internet. There's a horrible – level of negativity and attacks, Twitter mobs, and abusive
threats,
language,
and
things that are so tall. And it's empowered by the anonymity that people can be anonymous or people can hide behind some false thing. And nobody would come up to you and say some of the things that people write on Twitter. They'd get punched in the nose or they'd have to take responsibility for their comments. But it empowers cowardice. You can attack people. You can say horrible things. You can say racist things, misogynist things, whatever you want, and hide behind some false name. And even if you get banned from Twitter, then you pop up the next day with another new pseudonym. And also the whole structure of it, where how many characters is it, like 144
or something? It used to be 140. They expanded it now. It's too many. You can pretty much say whatever you want.
it's too many, maybe, but it's also not enough. I mean,
that's very true.
My main vehicle for interacting with the internet is still my blog. For the most part, when I post there, I post long things that, you know, if written on a typewriter or thing would be 3-4 pages of thoughts, or at least a page, several paragraphs. I develop arguments. I make jokes. I do things. And I can't talk in 140 character bursts here.
Yeah.
I mean, real discussion, any kind of meaningful dialogue between human beings is more nuanced than that. And there should be some give and take, and you should be able to make kind of fairly structured and complicated arguments or discussions. And the internet takes that away from us.
Yeah. I like to say the odds of you actually being able to change somebody's mind on Twitter and Facebook are just like non-existent. You know, like that's where people go to double down on whatever preconceived notions they have. And there's not a lot of wiggle room around that. After the break, George reminds us of something that's kind of obvious but also surprising, which is the fact that the HBO series wasn't actually always a sure thing.
I remember sitting around with them and saying, well, I hope we get at least 3 seasons because we really want to do the Red Wedding. That'll be, you know, an enormous thing. I hope we get at least that far.
And he names his favorite characters from Game of Thrones. You're listening to Nerdette.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
So, you mentioned upcoming HBO shows. I'm really curious to chat with you a little bit about what you see as the future of the genre of sci-fi and fantasy, because I know I've been very excited even just over the last couple of years about all the new stuff that's been coming out from folks like N.K. Jemisin and Nnedi Okorafor. And, you know, like there's some good stuff where you can tell these people grew up on the canon and are just like totally blowing it up in terms of their imagination and excitement. And I think it's really exciting. And I'm curious kind of what your take on that is, too.
Yeah, I'm very pleased and proud of the success that Game of Thrones has achieved. People ask me if I expected it. And, you know, that's no, of course I didn't expect it. How could you expect it? You know, when you start a book, you hope that it'll sell well. You maybe even dare dream that it'll be a bestseller and appear on the list. When you start a TV show, you hope it will get – first of all, you hope it'll get on the air.
Right.
Because I've been in this business a long time. Many shows don't get on the air. You write a pilot script, they never make it, or they make the pilot, but they decide not to do the series.
Well, and it's so funny looking
always,
at it.
You're always
from
worried
this
it won't
side.
Get that far.
Yeah.
And when we started Game of Thrones, David Benioff and Dan Weiss, the showrunners, and I remember sitting around with them and saying, "Well, I hope we get at least three seasons because we really want to do the Red Wedding. That'll be you know an enormous thing. I hope we get at least that far." And of course, we got a lot further than that.
Yeah,
and
you did.
It built and built. And yeah. One of the things, besides the individual success that the show has had and the impact it has had on my life, one of the things that I'm proudest about is the effect that it's had on fantasy. Because before Game of Thrones, if television did fantasy at all, and I was connected with some of the earlier fantasy shows, but they would put it on at 8 o'clock, mm-hmm. 7 Central, you know, which was called the family hour back in the 80s and 90s.
Uh-huh.
And you couldn't do anything too controversial or adult there, nothing to upset who small kids might be watching. Fantasy was considered a children's literature.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with children's literature. I grew up reading the Heinlein juveniles and you know, I've read The Hobbit. And, you know, when you're a child, you read children's books. But I think fantasy can be more than that.
Yeah.
And with HBO, with Game of Thrones, we showed something that readers had known for decades, because fantasy books written for adults had been on the bestseller list for 20, 30 years.
Yeah, the real nerds knew.
Right, right. Well, what's happened now, the enormous success of Game of Thrones has opened the floodgates. And right now, virtually every major fantasy is being developed by someone or other around the world. I mean, Amazon has both a Tolkien show going, and they're developing Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time. That's shooting right now in
mm-hmm.
Prague.
Mm-hmm.
Lin-Manuel Miranda is working with Patrick Rothfuss to do the Kingkiller Chronicles.
Uh-huh.
I love Patrick Rothfuss because he's the only fantasy author slower than I am.
That's true. That book has been long awaited, the third one of that trilogy.
And I mean, I could go on and on. There's many others.
Mm-hmm. His Dark Materials starts in just a couple
and
weeks.
I'm working at HBO on another Roger Zelazny project, and I'm working with Chicago's own Nnedi Okorafor
yes.
on Who Fears Death, her Afrofuturism science fiction fantasy book. All of these different people, Amazon, Netflix, Epics, Stars, the list goes on and on. They're all looking for the next Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, what will happen? Now, I think if one or two of these shows succeed, maybe not succeed on a Game of Thrones level, but succeed in that, oh, they have a nice 5-year run on television, mm-hmm. they get decent ratings, maybe they win a few Emmys or something like that. If one or two of them succeed, television will be transformed. Then I think fantasy will become a genre of television, just like cop shows and lawyer shows. I mean,
you never
see, oh, a cop show? We already have a cop show. We can't do that. It's always, oh, a cop show. Yeah, we'll put
more
on another cop show. And as a fantasy reader, someone who has read many of these works and loves these works, that's the outcome I would like to see. The danger, of course, is that if all of these shows fail for one reason or another, then I think television, which is run by success, will back off from fantasy and say, oh, no, Game of Thrones was a freakish one-at-a-time occurrence,
yeah.
and it can't be duplicated, so we won't do it anymore. And obviously, I don't want that to happen.
So speaking of the HBO show, do you have a favorite character that was brought to life through the show?
Oh, it's hard to pick one.
I mean,
they're all my
great.
Children, you know. Do you
yeah.
have a favorite child? I don't know. Tyrion Lannister is certainly
yeah.
a character that I've always loved
I mean,
writing
well,
about.
And Peter Dinklage just did
Peter
such
Dinklage
an amazing,
is amazing.
Job.
He's won 4 Emmys himself as Best Supporting
yeah.
Actor. He's great. But also the kids were marvelous.
God, yeah.
I mean, Maisie Williams as Arya and Sophie Turner as Sansa and Isaac as Bran, they were incredible.
Yeah.
And even more so because they came out of nowhere. I mean, Nina Gold, our casting director, found them doing like school plays. And,
that's
and
amazing.
You know, we had people coming right out of drama school, like John Bradley West, who played Samuel Tarly.
Uh-huh.
She
was
and
incredible.
And Amelia, to a degree, Amelia Clark.
Yeah.
She had done very
Daenerys.
Little before that.
Uh-huh.
You know, one kind of iffy horror movie and one commercial for women's shelters, and really very little on film. Kit Harington was doing War Horse on the West End, but really didn't have a lot of film or television experience.
Yeah.
So we were introducing a lot of new actors, and I think they've all acquitted themselves marvelously.
They have. I think Brienne of Tarth is probably my favorite.
Gwendolyn Christie. She is amazing. She is amazing.
Well, George R. R. Martin, thank you so much for chatting with me. It was really a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, my pleasure. It's fun.
How great was George? Wasn't he just like delightful? You know what's extra delightful is this other thing that I talked him into saying.
Hi, I'm George R. R. Martin, and you should listen to Nerdette Recaps His Dark Materials with Peter Sagal.
That's right, y'all. If you enjoyed Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Sagal, you might also like
Nerdette Recaps His Dark Materials with Peter Sagal.
We're still with Peter. We're going to recap His Dark Materials. It airs Monday nights on HBO starting this coming Monday. That means our recaps episodes will come out the following Tuesday afternoon. Obviously, we think it would be awesome if you watched the show along with us. There's also a whole bunch of books that the show is based on that are excellent. You don't have to do either of those things. If you just want to hang out with me and Peter and Trisha Bobita, just make sure that you are subscribed to Nerdette Recaps His Dark Materials with Peter Sagal. It's a really great acronym. It's NRHDMWPS. So easy, so simple, no vowels. I don't know why. That does mean that Nerdette proper is going to be taking a break while we do those recaps, so you can catch us on the other feed. And, of course, keep in touch with us by signing up for the newsletter, too. I put all kinds of great stuff in there. You can sign up for it at wbez.org/NerdetteAF. The show is produced by me, Greta Johnson, along with Justin Bull. Our co-creator is Trisha Bobita, and our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak. Nerdette is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. Go watch that weird show with us. Hopefully it's good. I have no idea. But I bet it's going to be good.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.